It's all what you're looking at. You know, your hand should ultimately become connected with your eye, and you feel that moment when it happens. And the only way to make that happen is to draw a lot and force yourself out of your comfort zone and force yourself to look.
Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. Today's episode focuses on the theme of essence, what it's like to capture the essence of a thing or a person or an idea or a feeling in art, particularly visual arts today. And with me today to discuss essence is Greg Emery. Thanks for coming on, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
Greg is a sketch artist and an abstract artist. He finished a gallery showing at the Agora Gallery just recently. He's also the head of visual arts at the Trinity School in New York. And you teach how many grades?
I'm in charge of 1st through 12th grade. I primarily teach in the middle and the high school.
So you get to see your students progress through many years.
Yes, and it's always a joy to witness that growth and to share once they graduate, because I've actually been teaching for now close to 20 years.
That's fantastic. Greg, you work primarily in abstract art and sketches, correct?
Correct.
So I met Greg at the Poetry Brothel, where he regularly attends and sketches people, which I didn't realize you do this for free. You do it pro bono. So if someone is standing around in a good pose, or the moment's really spectacular, he captures it in a very quick sketch and then gives it to the person. And sometimes they try to pay him or give him tips, and he'll just pay it forward to some of the performers.
Yeah, I always feel like if I leave with more money in my pocket, then it's somehow bad karma or bad luck. So I love being around that event. I think it's a real step back in time. Toulouse Lautrec is one of my favorite sketch artists and sketchiest guys. And so it really feels like I'm back in the 1800s or early 1900s. And in the day with the poets, with the burlesque dancers, with the live jazz, with the accordion players.
Right, and I thought I was just getting a special deal because I'd be playing accordion and then he'd hand me a sketch of whatever costume I was wearing. And lo and behold, he's doing this for everyone, which is really nice of you. I have a wall in my apartment covered with sketches of both me and my wife performing her Ariel. And you have other people who just show up in costume.
Well, you do get the special deal. I warm up drawing you every Poetry Brothel, so you get more. You get volume.
Thank you, Greg.
And quality. Quality is important.
That's great. And we're here today in his apartment where I'm looking at some of his abstract pieces, and they're all really fascinating. They have a distinct technique and style to them that we're going to get into and talk about soon enough. So describe for me what is important about essence to you, Greg.
Essence to me, I mean, I tend to tell people, I think they're surprised, that I have a hard time drawing things from memory. So I'm not one of those people that sits down and draws a horse from memory in perfect detail, or a sunset or whatever. I love and captivated by looking at the world around me, and I also say the world within me. I think the paintings tend to be more about what's within, and the paintings tend to be more what's surrounding me every day. And essence for me is capturing those moments, just a sense of that moment. They're mostly kind of based on gestures. Somebody resting their hands, their head in their hands, looking at a book, looking at a cell phone, a touch on a shoulder, a kiss at the Poetry Brothel. I've drawn a lot of kisses at the Poetry Brothel. Mm-hmm. And just capturing the essence of that moment. Somebody who witnesses that moment think it's a realistic drawing, but everyone else, it's just kind of a fingerprint on a window, or just a breath on a window, that you only get a trace element of what actually happened.
That's beautiful. I think you would have to be a sketch artist to capture a moment like that, because you don't have as much time unless they pose. Unless they stay in place, or you're a photographer, of course. But because you're dealing with these on-the-fly moments, and because there's this energy about it, you can see it in the trace of his hand, the lines that he chooses to represent something else that might have had much more detail had it been a photograph. But he does capture the very most essential and expressive lines. And I'm baffled by how you managed to do that so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and everybody always asks, how long does it take? And I generally say the best ones take, you know, 3 to 5 minutes. The worst ones take about 20 minutes to a half an hour. Because the more I labor over it, the worse it gets. And it tends to be, and this happens at the Poetry Brothel sometimes, it tends to be the ones that people ask me to draw them. And I think because I'm self-conscious, because they're self-conscious, it doesn't work as well. It kind of screeches to a halt. It's those moments that I catch a glimpse and people don't know I'm watching, that they're, you know, really, they're natural. They're in their natural sort of setting or state. They feel relaxed. That's what relaxes me, and that's what I get excited to draw.
Right, and you get one shot for each line.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably.
Well, that's what one of the things that the paintings and the drawings have in common. They're really a one-shot sort of deal. I set myself up. A lot of my grad teachers said I set myself up for failure. One said it's like stepping up to a plate in baseball with a full stadium. And it's not like you have three strikes. It's you're trying to slam a home run with the first swing, regardless of what pitch you get. So that's how I approach my painting. I approach them a lot like sports. I get psyched up. I limit myself. So I limit myself to just a few simple things, and then I try to make it happen. So it's also about being in the moment.
What would torture me as an artist would be knowing when to stop. When to say, that's it.
The drawings, it's easier. I do set up rules for myself, and I think every artist sets up rules. So as a kid, I didn't really like abstract work, but I started to realize that most abstraction has rules. May not look like it, but they do. But as an artist, you get to set up your own rules, which is kind of the coolest thing. So one of my rules in sketching, if I'm on the subway, if the person walks away, the drawing's done. You know, if I have to get off the train, the drawing's done. Sometimes I'll even hand it to him, even if it's half unfinished, because I do feel like there's a relationship going on. That's also part of the reason why I stopped charging. And I stopped charging when I really didn't have a whole lot of money, too. And people would offer me money, and I'd say no. I think it's weird that I would draw someone who didn't know and then ask for money. It felt wrong. It felt, you know, tawdry or scheming and
opportunistic.
Yeah, and I really wanted purity, and I wanted that to exist, and that I felt it was a relationship.
Well, that's downright decent of you, Greg.
I still made some money off of it, but
right.
But it was always give the drawing, and then if somebody insists on buying a dinner or buying a drink, or, you know, it's different. And the relationship is really still very important to me.
Would you be able to do as many sketches if there weren't as many people? Do you need people to do sketches?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the problems was when I lived in Jersey, nothing against Jersey. I love a lot of things in Jersey. But where I lived was almost all the way to Pennsylvania. There was one little mall a half an hour drive away. In the winter, I would drive to the mall and try to have sketches, but people are just walking to and fro and not sitting anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go to a bar, and the bars I'd find were really depressing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't easy. Almost any city I can find where people gather, and when I travel, even if it's in the country, you know, find where people gather. But I think I kind of have to live close or in a city to really get inspired all the time. And then definitely I go to the country. I'm going to China and staying in the country this summer. And I come from the country, and I do plenty of drawing when I'm visiting. But if I live there, then I think your work just changes. You know, I would probably do more paintings of the country and more, you know, different things, and it would change. But right now, like, I can't imagine living anywhere else.
So as you first learned to draw, you knew that you liked people?
Yeah, all the time. And I learned how to draw quickly because I lived an hour south of Montreal, and I drew hockey players.
Oh, cool.
So I would watch a hockey player, sketch a little bit, wait until he did the same move. Sketch a little bit more, and I'd give them free to them afterwards when they come off the ice. A lot of semi-pro players and people went on. I had friends who were playing, but I would draw all their friends.
What's the best part of a human that you like to draw? The whole outline, the body,
man,
the face.
Man or woman.
good point.
Burlesque dancer.
The face, the outlines, the skeletal structure, costume.
I think it's different for different people a lot of times. I definitely like the light and shadow. So, like, the House of Yes is awesome. Mm-hmm. So I like the lights and shadows that are cast on people's faces, and that I find really beautiful. Like I said, spaces in between people, older people, I kind of like the lines and wrinkles and stuff in their face. You know, but it's different on different people. The other day, drawing the jazz band, it was this jazz singer. It was like her back was amazing to draw.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. The dress.
Carte Blanche band.
So the lead singer of Carte Blanche was wearing a backless dress, and Greg has captured it with just a few lines and some smudges.
Mm-hmm.
And the drummer, the drummer's wearing suspenders and a tie. Or no, a vest and a tie.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite portraits that you've done is one of my wife and her aerial partner, mm-hmm. because it is a sketch, but it's so abstract that you just see limbs and a head, maybe two heads there, mm-hmm. but it perfectly captures them because it also suggests all the various twirling movements that they do in midair. And just to, you presented her with this sheet and it said, "This is you and and Sarah," and it could have been Guernica. It could have just been just a mess. An amazing mess. So how did you first become an artist?
I've always drawn. So since I could pick up a pen or a pencil, since before I could write, I made marks. And I think that's true of most people. But I think I really just never stopped scribbling and making marks and playing with, you know, the visuals of everyday life, whatever that might be. I did a lot of other things. I was interested in a lot of other things. But drawing is something I just... It's like what they say. It's the cliche that, you know, cliches are born from something. And this one's definitely true for me, that I didn't choose art. It chose me. You know, if I had done something else, you know, if I had been a lawyer, which I was also interested in, or things like that, I wouldn't have been fulfilled. It would have come back to haunt me, or I would have had to go back and do art.
Were you doodling in class?
All the time. You know, I think before it was actually proven, now in education it's proven that some people actually have to be doing something to pay attention better, kinetic learners or scribbling or playing with clay. That's how I learn. I actually pay attention better and retain more information when I'm drawing. I can listen and have a conversation. Well, I can hear words. I can't necessarily engage in a conversation when I'm drawing, but...
And now when you teach, if you're talking and you notice that someone is doodling, is there this full circle realization?
Yes, and I tell people, I think sometimes now I've been teaching long enough where I can tell if they're just pulling a fast one. And
is this something you can share with the rest with us? Not yet, I need a few more minutes.
Exactly. but I do, I tell people, if you feel like you have to draw while I'm talking, that's fine. If it feels like you didn't pay attention or you're not retaining things, then I may ask you to stop. I definitely try to pay attention to those lessons I learned when I was a kid.
So how did you transition from drawing into painting?
Well, at first, I pretty much was copying my drawings. I've always drawn people, and I don't think I'll ever stop drawing people. It really fascinates me. Part of me thinks I can draw everybody in the world. I've started to recognize people on the street, and then I realize it's from drawing, and I never even really met them. It's my way of making the world smaller, since I come from a small town. And so at first, I just kind of copied the drawings into paint. But I use a graphite stick to draw, so I started using pieces of wood to make the paintings to try and replicate the same marks. I'd use ketchup bottles for, like, lines for the people paintings. And then it just felt like a bad photocopy of my drawings.
Mm.
They looked good. They looked powerful. People were interested in them. But they felt less. They felt like a bad copy. A mimeograph copy. Like, you know, the 9th or 10th one. To me, it felt less powerful. And so you have to pay attention to that. And I made a big leap of faith. Wanted to challenge myself. And the challenge for me was to remove the figure completely. That was the scariest thing to do.
And when did that happen?
In grad school, towards the end of grad school. And once I did that, it was scary and exhilarating. You know, it's like the best first date that just keeps happening. So I removed the figure. It still to this day sometimes feels completely strange. It really is a lot like the best love you've ever had. You know, it feels fresh and new. You can't believe that this is what you're doing. But then you turn around and it remains interesting. And so I've stuck with a very simple circle, sometimes a swipe across it. And that's my process. And trying to find the essence of something by paring it down to almost nothing. And see, and honestly, to see if it still remains beautiful and powerful.
Right now I'm in Greg's apartment. And on the left, I'm looking at 3 stacks of sketchbooks that are slowly marking the halfway point. They're about 1/4 of the way up. He's got high ceilings. And then on the right, I'm looking at a, what is this, 4x4 canvas?
Mm-hmm.
4x4 canvas of a recent abstract painting, one of the circles. How many of these circle paintings have you made?
That's a really good question. I have no idea. A lot. And I do feel like, you know, the Sisyphus story rings in my ears every once in a while of like doing the same thing over and over again. And that is definitely a sign of insanity. But it, again, it remains interesting to me. The color, we haven't talked about the color. So there is an essence, there is an observational thing to these as well. The color I take from things I see. So the color of the abstractions can come from food. It can come from travel. A lot of them come from movies. So the one on the left actually was from...
So there's a smaller canvas than the 4x4. It looks like 2x2. That, it's all, right to the left of the bigger one.
Yeah. And so the... This is not the one from this one, but the idea is that I'll watch a movie. I'll look at travel photos I've taken or... all kinds of food.
So we're looking at a palette right now. Greg is showing me a palette of various colors that he has collated and collected. So what one is described as Mustang, another one is called Ladder, another one is Andreas Shirt.
So these were all colors based on watching Walking Dead Season 1, Episode 2.
Oh, so Andreas Gunn, Edge Sky Blue. Cooker. Rich's eyes.
Yes. So I look very closely, try to find colors. I think color is very powerful.
Wow.
Again, it's an essence sort of thing.
That's fascinating how you can get all of that from a TV show. I just listen for their incorrect dialects.
Exactly. Game of Thrones.
Oh, wow.
And then travel. So the Moroccan, you know, there's a page of Moroccan colors from the dye vats that I watched in Fez. So the colors I take from things I see, and then I'll use those colors as inspiration for the paintings. It's a way to keep my colors fresh and interesting, I think. And again, it's the way to look at the world. I also think color has a lot of memory and packs a lot of power and has a lot of provocation to it. And I think people feel that. People read that.
Right. And when... You have, if you work with just one single color on a white canvas, the effect is really, really striking. Do you ever mix them a lot?
I do. Not these particular ones. I think the ones I've been drawn to lately, again, a lot like the sketches, are the simpler ones that don't take as much working. It's not as many layers. But a lot of the ones that were featured in the last Agora show had a lot more color work, a lot of layering kind of going on.
This reminds me of Rothko's paintings where he works on combinations and playing with the effect of this color with this color, the same color with a different color at the bottom. Do you ever, so do you consciously work on combinations as well?
I do, and I like Rothko a lot. I think another thing that Rothko had was this real interest in spirituality. And so he really wanted people to sit in front of them and kind of meditate with those colors. And I think that's the best moment is to sit in front of a Rothko if you can ever find one where there aren't a million people around. That's kind of the best moment. And I like that about these two. I think they're meditative, but in a much more 21st century sort of way. It's, you know, Rothko on speed or something. So
the larger painting, I'm looking at this blue. What is the source of this blue?
So the source of this blue, the blue has come from many different places. And I think that blue is one thing that I keep kind of playing with. So actually the blue and the purple originally came from the series of paintings I was creating based on colors from Fire Island.
The smaller one is purple, by the way.
So they were originally based on these colors from Fire Island. So the Fire Island, the purple painting was based on kind of colors from the shell.
Ooh.
And the blue painting from the color of the water, but also the sky, and kind of a combination of those. But there's all kinds of blues everywhere. So to say it was just from those moments, I think would be dishonest. You know, a lot of the shades of blue that I've been mixing come from some of the movie colors as well. And I just keep kind of playing. Blue's something I've been playing with a lot. And the purples too lately.
And what would you want to convey in this color choice, in this stroke? Because you said that you like it when it's a meditative experience. Mm-hmm. What do you want your audience, your viewers, to meditate on the same thing that you meditate on?
Not necessarily. And I think people can bring their own views to it. I think there's two things for me. One is that a simple mark, the idea that a simple mark or a simple gesture can have many rippling effects. So, you know, there's really like two or three marks on this one blue painting. And the one that follows the one before reveals marks that you might not have seen in the first one, if that sort of makes sense. So the first one's kind of a clear, you know, almost a clear sort of white, but when you pull the blue over top of that, because it's the grain of wood that I'm using as my squeegee or dragging, it picks up the grain of the wood. When you sweep across the other way, the purple one has a sweep the other way, you see all these other marks kind of revealed from the other previous touches. And for me, that's, you know, that's a very personal thing that I think people notice the little beautiful intricacies and how did that happen? You know, one thing picks up another thing. But for me, it's the idea that one gesture, the butterfly effect, one gesture has rippling effects. And I tend to think of it as a positive, not like the Ashton Kutcher movie, but more of a positive rippling of effects from beautiful gestures.
So you have this theme of the circle, and the variations upon it have to deal with color choice, the size, the layout on the canvas. And then are there any other technical variations? You were mentioning the dragging of the wood on this purple one.
Yeah, and so really just how many layers. And that's kept me pretty interested for a long time.
Yeah. So it would be terrifying for me to try to do this circle.
Yes.
But you must have been doing it so many times and you waste this frame on it if you make a mistake.
Right.
Oh my goodness.
And most of the time if I make a mistake, those will turn into the more layered ones. And sometimes I won't like them and I'll tear them off and reuse the frame. And
wow.
So there is some frustration, but most of the time I'm kind of happy with what happens.
So when you teach, do you have your students do the perfect circle exercise?
I do not. But a lot of them have asked, mostly after they graduate, ask, you know, to show them how to do, you know, the type of painting that I do. I posted a video on my website that shows how I do it. And a lot of people think that takes the magic away. But I also, as a teacher, think a million people could follow my way of doing this and it would never be the same.
Right.
I could do this a million times, and there are going to be like snowflakes. None of them are going to be exactly the same.
Right.
And I think there's something kind of beautiful about that. For some people, there's something very boring about that too. For me, that's not true.
Right, but you've been doing this particular theme and this technique for so long that you really are looking for the differences,
mm-hmm.
and you can see them because he's very skilled at this circle.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever variations on it are what draw me to it if I were to look at a series.
Mm-hmm. Well, in little things like the relationship between how the circle doesn't quite make it to the edge.
Yeah.
And there's a tension between as things come together, like open space compared with painted space. There's a tension there that's really quite beautiful. And for me, again, that's also that essence that reminds me of that essence. I love the spaces in between people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how close people can get, especially on a subway. I'm fascinated. Thousands of sketches on subways all over the world where people don't even know each other and their space, you know, shapes each other or they're leaning into each other. And it's that palpable, powerful space just before people touch or kiss or hold hands or brush up against each other.
So, Greg, you just described the incomplete spot of the circle not quite exactly connecting, mm-hmm. becoming whole, to represent how you like the spaces of in between of people.
Mm-hmm.
How am I supposed to get that from looking at this?
You don't have to.
Right.
And some people, and my students keep me humble. Think this is crazy.
Right.
Like, that's art.
But I mean, that. Yeah, but I'd have to talk to you, or yeah. there would be a placard on the side, or there'd sure. be some sort of explanation, or if I had looked enough at paintings and thought, there's a space in between the circle becoming completely whole. That mm-hmm. reminds me of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do think you can go in a gallery, enjoy this work and other work without knowing all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's a problem, but also a cool thing about modern and contemporary art, that the more you learn about it, the more special the experience becomes. And I think that's true of theater, poetry, writing, movies, all different kinds of artworks, that you can have a very visceral experience. You know, I tell students it's the gut reaction to a piece. And I hope the more you learn, you don't lose that gut reaction. I think a lot of critics lose that gut reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you learn more about it, or you take your experience and apply it to what you're seeing or what you're hearing, then it becomes hopefully even more layered and interesting and meaningful.
Hi, everybody. Hey, if you're enjoying this podcast and would like to support it for free, please leave a positive rating and review of Neo Bohemia on iTunes. This will help me reach more listeners and possibly more guests to interview. And if you do this, message me, Charlie Layton, directly or at the Neo Bohemia Facebook page, and I'll send you a free sticker of the Pizza Rat logo. Thanks for listening, and now back to our program. Welcome back. We're talking to Greg Emery. Greg?
I think what's great about the work you do in abstract art in general is that the essence of it is about making connections based on how you respond.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I see this and I notice that the circle isn't complete, I may not get to that inspiration that you just
mm-hmm.
noted, but I will start making connections.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of provocative for me, is that it requires effort on the viewer. The viewer has to be willing to meet this painting, I think, and try to interact with it.
Well, and I also, one thing that stuck with me in art history was, and I forget which professor told me, but the idea in abstract work, there is a figure, and that figure is the artist. You know, I work on these on the floor. Like, you can see my arm length. You can see my limits when they get bigger. But it's also the audience. So there is a figure. It's your relationship to the work. Sometimes you're invited to walk onto the work or into the work. And you know, I also think of Jackson Pollock's quote, my favorite Jackson Pollock quote, where, you know, a lot of artists had said, I'm inspired by nature, I love nature, I replicate nature. Pollock said, I am nature.
Oh.
So he's part of the work. And I think when you walk up close to a Pollock and you can't see anything else except painting all around you, you can get an idea of that kind of ferocity that was him. And I think that's true of any abstract work, that you're part of that work. Sometimes you're pushed away. Sometimes you're drawn in. And I think that's really important. You are the figure in relation to the artwork.
That reminds me of Van Gogh's painting In the Night Cafe as well. I believe that's the first time that he created from memory or imagination, and how it was almost a spiritual crisis for him because he was used to having a source in front of him, something that was clearly natural and external, but having to do it from his own mind really pushed something in him emotionally, psychologically, and it was really provocative.
Well, it's funny you said that because that's probably my favorite Van Gogh painting. I think possibly because of that idea that so much of his work is from observation, and a lot of the work people really are drawn to is flowers, is sunflowers that are drawn from observation. And that particular piece is so inviting and so bright, but so dismal.
Yeah.
And the people just seem cold and distant from each other. And it really is also like an ode to absinthe, I think, at the time as well. And this loneliness in the painting for being so bright, one of the brightest paintings, it's one of the loneliest paintings I've ever seen.
So when you made the jump from sketch artist with external source to abstract artist working on this technique and this theme, was it just a clear thing that popped in your mind, or were you working with how did you come to this idea that you were going to make a career out of painting countless circles?
I believe that the jump came from working a lot. So drawing all the time, painting all the time, which grad school allows. But I joke even with teaching that I have 2 full-time jobs. So I'm always painting, I'm always drawing, I'm always going to museums, I'm going to the brothel. I'm living and breathing art as much as I can, which means living and breathing and really drawing from life. So the jump came when I was at this apex of working all the time and painting all the time. But I was looking for some change. I had noticed this in my work. I was frustrated. And I literally went home and had a dream where one of my big figurative paintings was there. And physically in space, I kind of dragged black across part of it.
Wow.
And sort of destroyed a big part of the painting. But it was kind of, you know, it gave me the impetus, gave me the permission to jump into this other thing, and realized how scary it felt, like a nightmare, how scary it was to make that first sort of jump. But it was the best thing to do. It was the most important thing to do.
And from there you had the vision to create these, I mean.
Yeah, the original gestures were, you know, kind of circles or, you know, half circles. It was really using the gestures that were in my drawings, but not creating a figure or a table or a city or anything out of them.
Right.
And trying to let them just be marks and see what I could do with that.
So let's go back to sketch art.
Yep.
What's the best advice you can tell a young sketch artist beginning? So the thing is, it can't take too long. You have to let it go. It's about a moment.
The biggest, those definitely, I'd say the biggest is most of us when we're drawing and first learning how to draw, and me when I'm not drawing very well, look at our paper and look at our drawing maybe 80% of the time and what we're trying to draw 20% of the time or less. And the answers are all up. It's all what you're looking at. You know, your hand should ultimately become connected with your eye, and you feel that moment when it happens. And the only way to make that happen is to draw a lot and force yourself out of your comfort zone and force yourself to look. To look really closely and let your eye guide your hand. Because the only other thing that's guiding your hand is the part of your brain that tells you you don't know what you're doing.
Hmm.
So
it's a matter of coordination?
Yeah, and you're fighting your brain, which has developed symbols for things. And there's a lot of different parts to it. You know, it's like I play the drums. It's like playing the drums. You're teaching one hand how to do something while your other hand's doing something else, while your foot's doing something, and you're trying to pay attention and read some music, maybe even.
Right.
It's a lot like that. It's a language.
So you have to really be present with the subject if yes. you're trying to capture its essence.
And draw a lot. So I think work is the most important thing to sort out mistakes and get better. You cannot become a better drawer by drawing a little bit and then maybe a month later picking up the sketchbook again. I feel myself getting worse if I don't draw every day. If I don't draw for 2 or 3 days, I feel my personality getting different.
Wow.
And on the rare occasion that hasn't happened in years, if I don't draw for a week, you don't want to be around me.
I think that's to be said for all artists, that you have to just show up for the discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting your technique down. Because you could have something amazing to say, but if you don't have enough technique or if you don't have enough skill, you might not get the complete message across.
Sure.
It could be lost in muddledness or a lack of detail or a lack of proficiency. I feel the same way about music, about playing my accordion. I need to do it almost on a daily basis, try to schedule that. Same thing with writing, and I write almost every day as much as I can in a journal, and I'm not even writing to make something profound. I'm just writing to see what it's like to truly feel free for minutes at a time without the criticisms in my head, without overthinking it, overanalyzing it, without getting stuck. And even if the page isn't that great, what I wrote, at least I have a moment where I was focused and I was creating something from my brain. And I think that that's important to experience before inspiration even shows up.
It's very important. And I think we also don't give ourselves enough opportunity to make mistakes. And I think especially I feel bad for kids today that aren't allowed to make mistakes. They don't allow themselves and other people don't allow them to make mistakes. And I think in the arts and actually in sports, you have to make mistakes to get better. You know, Michael Jordan got cut from his high school basketball team, you know, and when he was interviewed after big games, he would always talk more about the shots he missed than, you know, the records he broke. And he would be the first one in the gym the next day to shoot, you know, 100 shots for every one he missed. I think, yeah, that's really inspiring, but you also have to pay attention. You know, they're not just gods. They made mistakes. The show that's at the Met, the new Met, that features in the old Whitney Museum, Breuer, that features Unfinished, I think it's a brilliant show where you get to see mistakes. You get to see paintings that were never finished by masters. Including Van Gogh, including others, and sketchbooks. I love seeing artist sketchbooks where you see mistakes and you see ideas and you see practice. And we don't show that enough. We only show the finished product.
Right. So did you see that exhibit?
Several times. Yeah.
And what was your response? Was it more like, keep going, or, oh, this is, you stopped at the right spot? Or
yeah, I mean, most of the time I'd rather see an unfinished piece than a finished work. It's more appealing to me. I think I like a lot of street art because of that, because it's a little more free. It's a little less polished, not mm-hmm. all of it, but you know, work like by Swoon, who's crossed over into the galleries and museums and back and forth, but she keeps this freshness in her work. It never feels finished. And I think that's really difficult to do. And I think that's one thing I really like in my work. That it has this fresh quality, like I just stepped away from it.
So when you teach painting to your students, do they start with a source or do they get to do more abstract work?
I try to allow for both with any grade. I mean, there's a differentiation between age levels, but for instance, my ninth graders right now, a wonderful class. They, you know, have been allowed to, you know, right now we're working on a monochromatic painting. They had to choose, you know, I gave them a list of things that they had to include in the painting, but they could do that anyway. Things like an architectural effect or detail, an atmospheric effect. And they planned out and kind of came up with an idea. Once they were almost finished with their drawing, we also talked about the idea that every work of art is a self-portrait.
Hmm.
And they had to really reflect on that and, you know, kind of reshape their idea to include that. Not include a picture of themselves, but really to think on that idea before they resolved their sketch.
Wow.
And it's a monochromatic painting. But at the same time, their homework, I've given them each a t-shirt, big extra large men's white t-shirt, and they are working on ripping it apart and re-putting it back together to somehow be inspired by one of the principles of design. So things like balance and symmetry and texture and contrast. And you know, so I try to give a balance of types of work and types of thinking.
That's so great, because you're telling them that, in a sense, because they're choosing to make art, it will be a reflection of their identity.
Always. I think it always is.
And that's really, I mean, having a strong sense of yourself is, and a perspective, a sense of identity, can really help sustain you, because it's easy to get lost,
mm-hmm.
and to get blocked and to lose continuity.
Right. Well, I think that's also why you go to see Hamlet performed 40 different times. You don't just go for Hamlet, even though the words are beautiful and the story mm-hmm. makes, you know, is intriguing and has ups and downs. We also go for the actors, because you see their personality reflected in those words, and how are they going to twist it? How's the director? How's the lighting person? How are they all going to, you know, put a little bit of themselves into this work?
Right. Watch for the variations.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice can you give to an abstract artist starting out? Someone willing to make that jump into...
I would say it would be one of the same piece of advice I would give to the sketchbook people or a photographer or anybody else, is to try to be true to yourself, to try not to just imitate what you see,
mm-hmm.
Which is very difficult as a student. I think you have to go through a period of imitation and then, you know, try to find yourself in that, but it's difficult. So I'd also say no art history, like go to museums a lot, go to shows, you know what's been done, so you can riff off of that like a jazz musician, or, you know, become yourself. And I think just be true to yourself, and the same thing, put the work in, you know, find out what type of an artist you are. It took me a while to find out, you know, it's okay to work quickly. That's who I am. But I have a realistic painter friend who's amazing. But he spends months and months and months on the same painting, and that's who he is. So I think you have to find your process and find who you are and make up your own rules, and realize you can break them or change them at any time, because you're in charge.
Great. So when you're a sketch artist or an abstract artist and you're working with your source, and very often the source is a person, do you feel as though that person can affect what you're doing, like it's a collaboration, like it's a dialogue?
Yes, definitely.
You recently finished a project with the Sydney Shift Dance Company. Do you care to elaborate?
Sure. It was a really exciting project that started with drawing. Sydney had seen me sketching at a local jazz club and approached me about collaborating. I said, sure. She actually went online and saw my paintings and knew she had found the artist she wanted to work with. She wanted to work with a visual artist. I didn't realize that most of the rest of the performance was done. The musicians had already rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
So it left about three to four weeks to get everything done, the planning. And the basic idea was there were four main dancers in the production. They each got to choose a site around New York that inspired the choreography. And I felt strongly about the colors used in the paintings that are similar to my abstractions would be inspired by those spaces as well. So I went to each of the spaces, sat and did color swatches, you know, places like Cafe Piccola, down on, I think, 72nd in Amsterdam, and sat there and ordered food and looked around and took color swatches and created a painting based on those colors that was then transformed into the costume that the dancer wore. So my physical paintings were kind of taken apart and re-put back together, and the colors and marks came to life. So there were three shows in Brooklyn.
Nice.
And I was speechless. I brought my sketchbook to draw the dancers, and I didn't make a mark because I was just speechless watching my paintings move in front of me.
That's so cool.
In a beautiful way. So I think collaboration is an amazing thing to shake you up and get you rethinking what you're doing.
Do you maintain your own personal sense of essence when working with others?
I think it's difficult sometimes. I think I've collaborated a lot with different people over the years, and composers, and all kinds of different people. But I think that's difficult, and I think you have to find the right people to collaborate with. I think I fell into the Poetry Brothel. I think it's a great group of people that are willing to kind of give and take, but not give up anything that's important of who they are, and pay attention to the people around them, you know, and kind of take care of each other. That's tough to find. But I've been lucky to have a few moments like that over the past couple of years.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Greg. How are we able to find your work?
Easiest way is checking out online, gregemery.com. That's my personal website with my paintings. I post a lot of the collaborations. You can see some images from the dance collaboration. If you look on Instagram, it's Greg V. Emery. And my drawings I used to do under a different name, Appleseed21, APLSD21. You can still find a site that has just my drawings on there. The Instagram's a combination of both.
And I will provide links in this podcast. Well, thank you, Greg. This was Greg Emery. I'm Charlie Layton, and this was Neo Bohemia. Thanks, everyone, for listening.